Okay, we're gonna start now. So 30 minutes for each person. And we begin with Abhay Ashtekar.
So we were given this task, Steve and I, to speak in this session, the future of WWDC. We try to coordinate loosely. And I guess needless to say, I begin with the quote from the board. It's difficult to make predictions, especially about the future. So, what I'll do is to sort of basically cover a little bit of classical gravity and quantum gravity, which has not been covered so far at all, and Steve will cover more of quantum gravity. So, as we saw in the last few sessions, can you see me? We saw in the last couple of days, and in fact this morning also, that there have been really major advances on the conceptual and mathematical front, conceptual in the sense of how do you extract physics from the mathematical framework of general relativity, and then development of mathematical tools to do so between the 60s and the 80s. And they were kind of within the field, there have been some paradigm shifts. I mean, we heard about singularity theorems, because before these theorems came along, there was a suspicion that perhaps the singularity is an artifact of excessive symmetry, and a general solution of Einstein's equations would not have them. Then there were these positive energy theorems, and this was kind of, I think, the first time when really geometric analysis came into general relativity in a full-fledged way. It's not that there was not there before, but the community moved in, so to say, because of Yao and Shon. And positive energy theorems also proved to be valuable tools for geometric analysis. Then this, before that, however, there was also the physics of gravitational waves in full non-linear general relativity, as we heard from Cliff, that there was all this confusion about, you know, whether gravitational waves are real in full non-linear theory, even though Einstein himself had shown, had worked out the gravitational wave theory in the linearized context. And that was all cleared, as we heard, by the work of Bondi's group, and then Penrose, Newman, and collaborators. And then there was we also heard about black holes, and uniqueness theorems, and black hole thermodynamics. And these were, each time this happened, there was a paradigm shift. And certainly with black hole uniqueness, for example, it was widely believed, even after Isidore's theorem came about, that in fact a lot of people believed the other way, right? They thought that, well, okay, if in fact the only static black hole is spherically symmetric, that means that, but if you look at stars, stars have all kinds of, they're not spherically symmetric, you know, they've got electricity, they've got all. And therefore, the belief was that, well, certainly if such a star collapsed, you do not make a black hole, right? Because black hole already is spherically symmetric. And it was Penrose who really forcefully argued that multiple moments will have to be radiated away, and it will be actually a black hole. So there are paradigm shifts that are occurring all along, and Penrose's ideas were confirmed in perturbation theory by Richard Price soon after, and the work in geometric analysis is continuing. These results are here. Then, evolution of the field since then, and about future, I think the field has really matured a lot as a field as a whole. So it's qualitatively different now than when it was when I started out in the field. In particular, general relativity has extended its reach tremendously, but also it has moved away from the time of mathematical directions that dominated general relativity before 1980s. The key examples, as I said, was geometric analysis, as we heard this morning, about how there is much more emphasis now on PDEs. Previously, the singularity theorems, etc., really proved using much more emphasis on geometry than on analysis. And now there is much more emphasis on rigorous global existence and uniqueness theorems. And the kind of mathematical relativity sort of is now that is being done is moved into the mathematics department by and large. Numerical relativity, especially in the last decade, has made a huge leap, and we heard about it from news this morning. Particularly, I think, not only coalescence of black holes themselves, but black holes and neutron stars, and this now, in the last, you know, last 7 years or so, including hydrodynamics and magnetohydrodynamics, is really changed the field enormously. with gravities and waves and astrophysics. And then really we have learned new things. I mean, this morning there was a question about the equation of state, and one other thing that of nuclear matter, and from neutron stars, from the fact that we don't see any gravitational waves from the Crab pulsar, tells us that there are no mountains higher than a meter high on Crab pulsar. Because if there are mountains like that, then the contrapole moment is changing sufficiently that the current sensitivity of LIGO detectors, one would be able to actually see them. And so this is fantastic, right? I mean, that one can see this. And then this also let the community put some limits on the nuclear matter that are very weak limits. They only rule out some exotic equations of state. And more than that, now I think, you know, for the first time, because of gravitational waves, gravity had joined the other fundamental forces of nature. You see, for all along, I mean, for centuries, all our information about the universe has come through electromagnetic interaction, light. Then it began to be in infrared, then gamma rays and radio astronomy and so on. But it's all electromagnetic. Then, you know, another 20 years ago or so, people started looking at the universe also using neutrinos, the weak interaction, the weak force. And then the P. Roger in Argentina looks at the universe using strong interaction, strong forces. And now finally, gravity actually had joined this, and we are really going to be looking at the universe using all four fundamental forces of nature. And for example, in particular at Penn State, we initiated a project called AMON, which brings together information from all these diverse observatories. It took a lot of work, but finally there have been memorandum of understanding from very many observatories. And the idea is to pull together information that comes from very, very different channels and see if we can get a more holistic picture of the universe than we had before. And finally, we heard these spectacular talks yesterday on cosmology and the cosmic microwave background fluctuations. The physics that we understand today, physics, astrophysics, gastrophysics that we understand today, is so detailed that by starting at 380,000 years ago, when the universe was 380,000 years old, that is to say the cosmic microwave background, and looking at the tiny inhomogeneities in them, they evolved to give us the large-scale structure of the universe today, and that is something that we can put in. Of course, you use computers, but you can actually put in all the physical principles to agree qualitatively with the large-scale structure that we see around us. In human terms, if you just divide 380,000 years by, you know, 30 million years, you see that it is equivalent in biology to looking at a snapshot of a baby when the baby is one day old and predicting how the person would look like when the person is 100 years old. So imagine how much, you know, detailed understanding of biochemistry, physiology, biology one would need to know. And it's amazing that we have this baby picture of the universe and we can tell what the adult universe looks like now. So all these things have been spectacular progress, I think. There are a few conceptual problems still open on the classical front. I gave an example the other day, so I just want to sort of spell it out. Recall that there was a considerable confusion about reality of gravitational waves in full non-linear general relativity before 1960. And it is a Bondi and Sachs et al. Framework that settled the issue. And then Penrose's construction of null infinity sort of made it all very precise. We have, because this is null infinity, it's null, it is ruled by null geodesics, that gives you some rigid structure. So the symmetries have to preserve this ruling of scribe, of this null infinity. That tells you that the group of symmetries, asymptotic symmetries, is not the diffeomorphism group, but in fact is a much smaller group, that is a body mass and Sachs group. And then Sachs showed that it admits a unique four-dimensional normal subgroup, of which we can call asymptotic translations for very good reason. So asymptotically, we know what we mean by time translations, space translations. Therefore, because of the symmetries, we can define energy, momentum. And in fact, we have Bondi gave us a gauge invariant notion of the gravitational waves in full nonlinear general relativity. We had this Bondi news tensor. Later, it was realized that one can Bondi call it news function, but actually is a tensor. And this tensor is actually built out of curvature of the connection on scribe, intrinsic connection on scribe that we have. And so it's very, you know, it's understood, it's very nice. And in fact, you can have a star which is emitting these gravitational waves, and you can calculate the Bondi energy here, you can calculate the Bondi energy here, and you have a nice balanced law. which says that the body energy here is equal to the body energy here. These are two spheres in the integral, plus whatever energy was radiated away by gravitational waves. So this is all very beautiful. But in the meanwhile, we also learned through this huge mission that, in fact, almost all astronomers and physicists believe that, in fact, the universe does have a positive, small, but positive cosmological constant. One's first impulse is to say that, well, it's so small, so you know, we can just easily extend the known framework to this case. But it turns out that the limit is discontinuous. When you've got a positive cosmological constant, sky is actually space-like, not null, and all kinds of structures happen. So in particular, it is not ruled by anything, and therefore the group of asymptotic symmetric group is a group of diffeomorphisms of sky. We don't know what energy means. We don't know what momentum means. We do not have these basic notions like Bondi news or these kind of balance laws or positive energy theorems or fluxes. We do not know how to impose the analog of no incoming radiation on sky minus. And we don't know what gravitational waves mean in full nonlinear general relativity in presence of a cosmological constant. So this is an example. And I don't think there are many such problems, but there are some problems like that that can be handled by the kind of mathematics that was taught to us by Penrose and Gerosch and Hawking and these people. Okay. So now this is that was the first part of classical relativity. Now let me turn to quantum physics. So unifying general relativity with quantum physics. Already in 1916, Einstein wrote, nevertheless, due to the inner atomic movements of electrons, atoms would have to radiate not only electromagnetic, but also gravitational energy, if only in tiny amounts. As this is hardly true in nature, it appears that quantum theory would have to modify not only Maxwellian electrodynamics, but also the new theory of gravitation, namely general relativity. So Einstein in 1916 was aware of quantum gravity, necessity of quantum gravity. Almost a century has passed. Significant time and effort has been devoted to create a satisfactory unification. Major advances in quantum field theory in curved space-time have occurred, involving black holes, the Hawking effect, and the very early universe that we heard about yesterday, where especially the inflationary paradigm, but also other paradigms of early universe where quantum fields and curved space-time play a big role. But the more general problem of unifying quantum gravity, general relativity with quantum physics remains is still open. So one would ask why. Of course, the standard answer that everybody hears often is that, well, you know, this problem is difficult because there are no experiments. So we don't have any guidance. And that is certainly true. But that can hardly be the case. That can hardly be the full reason, right? Because if there are no experiments, it's a theory's heaven, right? I should be able to produce one theory a day, right? I mean, I don't have any constraints. I should just be able to produce that. And we don't have a single one. So obviously that is not the only answer, right? That cannot be the only answer. We do not have a single complete consistent theory. So my viewpoint of the central difficulty is that in general relativity, as we have emphasized many times here, gravitational field is encoded in the very geometry of space-time. And therefore, a quantum theory of gravity should lead to a quantum space-time geometry. And then the question arises, particularly for philosophy of science, for example, how do we do physics without a metric in the background? What do you mean about dynamics? What do you mean about time evolution if you don't have Lorentzian metric in the background? How do we even formulate the physical questions that we have been discussing in the last few days? Now, early attempts to bypass this difficulty was to treat general relativity as any other field theory and use perturbating methods. So this originated with Feynman, but then was developed much more by DeWitt and by many, many people. And the idea was to split the geometric and the gravitational roles of the metric. So to get away from this difficulty, you write the metric as the flat metric plus a perturbation, and you think of this flat Minkowski metric as determining the geometry, and let HAB encode the gravitational field. Then we have background geometry. This gravitational field, quote unquote, is actually propagating on that background geometry, and then we can just, quote unquote, quantize this field and do quantum gravity. But this perturbative strategy fails by its own criterion. The theory is not renormalizable. What that means is basically it has infinitely many undetermined parameters, and therefore no finite number of experiments will tell us what to do. It has no predictive powers. So it is relatively recently that we learned lift this anchor that tied us to background space-time continuum and sail the open seas, so to say. And for this, we, meaning we, the broader community as a whole, the community had to develop new concepts to handle these issues that I referred to, and also appropriate mathematical tools, which are novel, not just classical differential geometry anymore, to first phrase and then analyze the appropriate question. And it is only recently that we have sufficient questions that we got. So I have to say that what happened is that my computer crashed this morning, and I had to redo the talk, and that's why I've been working furiously. So there may be some typos. So it is only recently that we have sufficient mathematical techniques to address the physical issues. Okay. So broad strategies are the following, right? So there is a similarity. Quantum gravity problem shares a similarity with general relativity problem. Einstein was sort of consumed by this fact that Newtonian gravity and special relativity are incompatible with each other, and we want a grander theory. Well, and he succeeded in 8 years and gave us general relativity. Right? And then we have been trying to find out its spectacular consequences since then. But in fact, and so the point was that there is an incompatibility between the underlying fundamental theories of the day. And today, we have general relativity and quantum physics, and there is an incompatibility, and we are again seeking a great unification. Because of this similarity, people often would like to say, be disappointed by the fact that not much has happened in quantum gravity compared to what happened in 8 years for Einstein up here. But I think gauging progress in physics particularly, one should keep in, I feel it is important to keep in mind that the discovery of general relativity was more of an anomaly than a rule. Quantum theory is more representative of how paradigm shifts occur in science. A century has passed since its discovery, and yet fundamental issues still remain. Like on the conceptual side, what was referred to as a measurement problem, we still have that problem. On the mathematical side, we still do not have a single, complete, coherent, interacting quantum field theory in 4 dimensions. And yet, everybody would agree that quantum mechanics has been spectacularly successful, right? And as we just pointed out, it also has to do with industrial applications and so on, but also at the theoretical level, it has entered so many different areas. And indeed, I think that we would agree that it has been more spectacularly successful than general relativity has been. So therefore, it's perhaps useful for quantum gravity to follow the take lessons from quantum. So for quantum gravity should take lessons from the evolution of quantum theory. And here the progress was made by focusing on physical problems and applying the quantum principles to them. And so this might be a good strategy, namely, don't try to do the full theory, but look at some physical problems and apply principles that you believe are fundamental from quantum gravity to those principles up here. So there are three leading approaches that I would like to talk about. I first had a list of several approaches that I realized there was no way I could do it in half an hour. So I'd like to talk about three approaches. One is called asymptotic safety. That may not be so known, so I thought I'd at least mention it. I'm not an expert in asymptotic safety. Neither am I an expert in string theory. I follow them with great interest at a distance. Steve probably knows more about it than I do. So the idea here is to select. So let me just first tell you the idea and then explain it a little bit. To select among theories that are already quantum, you look for islands of physically acceptable theories in the sea of unacceptable ones. The unacceptable ones are the ones which are plagued by short distance pathologies. And so the spirit is really non-perturbative renormalization instead of perturbative renormalization. So what does it mean? So the idea is this, that if you have a quantum theory, you might be able to write down an effective action. I'm short-circuiting a lot of things, driving brain deep. You might be able to write down an effective action, which will have many, many quantum corrections. And the leading part will be classical, it will have all possible quantum corrections. And then the idea is that the variation of this action, the solutions of this action, will tell you, in principle, will have information about the full quantum theory. And the idea here is to try to find these effective actions. So what one does is, in principle, what one'd like to do is to consider the infinite dimensional theory space. Now, what does it mean? Supposing we're interested in gravity, and we think that is a metric theory of gravity. Then you write down a Lagrangian, which has all possible terms compatible with diffeomorphism in values. Of course, there are infinitely many terms. So formally, you allow them all, right? I mean, which is Riemann tensor square, cube, 100 million power, and so on. So in front of each of them, there will be some coupling constants up here. Then the idea is to use Wilson's renormalization group equations. They actually would provide a flow, that is a philosophy. They would provide a vector field, a flow, in this particular theory space up here. And then the question is, does the physically acceptable trajectory exist? If it would exist, if there is a, what is called an ultraviolet fixed point, that corresponds to removing the ultraviolet cutoff. So the effective action would actually contain the full theory, if you like. The full effective action would be at this ultraviolet fixed point. And then the idea is that there are coupling constants, which are which detail the theory in the Lagrangian. They flow depending on what energy scale you are looking at. And thus we acquire an effective theory at each scale in which the degrees of freedom of the at a shorter smaller energy scale or longer scales up here are integrated out. So in practice, what one does is really truncate to just a few number of terms in the Lagrangian, but there has been impressive technical progress. There are non-trivial ultraviolet fixed points have been shown to exist, you know, depending on how you count, 10 to the 20 terms in the Lagrangian, and these are ultraviolet time. These points are now providing us some theories. And first this was done for pure gravity, and more recently for matter couplings. And the non-trivial point survives, and the candidates, and these are the candidates for completions of what is known as a low-energy effective theory. The second thing is the string theory. And the original idea here was bad ultraviolet behavior of quantum field theory comes from the use of points and particles, or point particles, and that could be cured by instead using extended objects. First, people used just strings, one-dimensional extended objects, but then they later found that, in fact, higher dimensional extended objects also have to be added. Particles are to be thought of as excitation modes of a string. So particles are not fundamental thing, they're just excitation modes of a string. And the hope was that this theory would have not only quantum gravity, but also natural unification of gravity with other forces. But to have a coherent theory, one has to have higher dimensions, supersymmetry, and infinite tower of fields and particles. None of this was necessary in asymptotic safety scenario. And initially, the theory was formulated as a perturbation theory, but the perturbation theory was not found to converge. And therefore, about 15 years ago, there was a shift, and people looked at a non-perturbable definition of string theory via the so-called ADS-CFT correspondence. The main idea here is that quantum gravity in a bulk space-time, which is asymptotically anti-de Sitter, is actually asymptotically anti-de Sitter space-time, is really defined as a conformal field theory on the boundary of this space-time. So interestingly, this non-perturbability definition brings us back to a local quantum field theory. But there is such a definition, and people are exploring it. The limitations are that quantum gravity is first of all in 10 dimensions, there is a negative cosmological constant, and large extra dimensions. So for example, normally you think of this extra dimension being curled up in a Kaluza-Klein spirit to Planck scale or something, but these extra dimensions have to have radius which is comparable to the cosmological radius, cosmological constant radius. So if I look up, I should be able to see them. And therefore, this is not really the physical world that we inhabit. But there is a major achievement. And the major achievement in the mathematical side is that, as was pointed out by Lewis this morning, non-gravitational systems such as fluids, superconductivity, and quadruon plasma are described using gravitational techniques. Even though the systems used so far are idealized, I think this actually brings out some underlying unity of physics and at the mathematical level, and I think that's very interesting. Then finally, I would like to talk about loop quantum gravity. The central ideas here is really to shift the emphasis from metrics to connections, to import techniques from Gauss series. Now, this idea actually was, the historians would know, was something that Einstein and Schrodinger themselves tried, but they had used the Levi-Civita connection, and the equations become complicated, But if you use spin connections, equation simplified, and that is what one uses, and one imports techniques from gauge theories. You have got holonomies and spin networks. These are at forefront. Holonomies are basically parallel transport, the result of parallel transport of these connections. And spin networks provide for you, I mean, the lines, so spin networks like graph, the links or the lines of this graph are the curves along which you take the holonomies. And the vertices, if you like, then in this, you are led to a quantum geometry, and the vertices tell you about how much volume there is. And if I take any two surfaces, the intersection of the two surfaces, with the spin network determines how much area it has. The flux of the spin network through a surface gives us a geometry, a quantum geometry, the area. There is actually, these quantum geometry operators actually have discrete eigenvalues, and the area gap plays an important role in dynamics. So proposals for dynamics of the full theory have been studied in great detail, particularly via spin forms. This is a path integral type of approach within loop quantum gravity. There are very interesting results on ultraviolet finiteness, basically because there are no degrees of freedom at the arbitrary small scales. And there's also infrared finiteness results in presence of positive cosmological constant. But the theory is still very incomplete because it is still formulated using a simplicial decomposition of space-time manifold, and conceptual issues remain. So the strategy that has been extremely successful is to truncate general relativity according to the physical problem of interest and apply the loop quantum gravity techniques, especially quantum geometry. This strategy has led to a resolution of a few long-standing problems, for example, resolution of singularities in cosmological models, a derivation of a graviton propagator in the non-portability context, and an approach to black hole entropy based on accelerated horizons. Okay, now I'm going to tell you the fourth part, so I don't have enough time, so I'll just do is to summarize in words mainly. The fourth part was really to give you a flavor of the interplay between observations and theory. For the longest time, people are saying, including me, that quantum gravity is very far from making observations. But we heard of these spectacular advances that have happened in cosmology recently, and therefore it opens us a new window for actually addressing some quantum gravity issues in the cosmological context. And there's an interplay between theory and observations. We can make some predictions which could be observed, and similarly, we can take observations to educate us as to look for new physical principles, for example, in the choice of initial conditions. So let me skip and go to this point up here. Namely, in the inflationary dynamics, normally, you hear often the statement that whatever happened before the inflation would not matter. The Planck scale physics which happened before inflation would not matter, because it will all be diluted away. The reason that people give this is the following. That if I plot here times and if I plot here lengths, then I got to say the Hubble radius, one upon Hubble parameter is being plotted here. So during the exponential expansion, it is constant. And here what I'm plotting are some modes of perturbations. The idea is that the wavelength of these modes before the start of inflation, observable modes, is actually the modes which are observable in cosmic microwave background. This wavelength is smaller than the Hubble radius. Now if you look at the detailed equations, if the wavelength is much smaller than the Hubble radius, then surprisingly the modes actually propagate as though they are in flat space, even though the curvature is very large. And so the idea up here is that, whenever these modes come up, whatever happened before doesn't matter because they will never be excited. Here they are really in the Bunch-Davis vacuum. Even if there were some excitations of the Bunch-Davis vacuum, people believe that, they will be diluted away during inflation. These are shown in great detail by people like Leonard Parker, even Ivan Aguillo, that if there are excitations, they are not diluted away, they actually remain. And now something very interesting happens. Namely, so what happens in loop quantum cosmology? In loop quantum cosmology, the singularity is resolved. So the Hubble parameter doesn't become infinite, it remains finite, therefore the Hubble radius doesn't go to zero, it remains finite. So the radius of curvature up here, forget about this line up here, just look at this line.
the radius of curvature up here is actually going to be not zero, it's going to be finite. Therefore, I could have some modes whose wavelength in the Planck regime is larger than the curvature radius. So during this evolution, they would actually be experience the curvature, and afterwards, the wavelength is again shorter than our radius, but still they are already excited, and therefore they will come up here excited. And therefore, at the onset of inflation, I would not have the Bunch-Davis vacuum. So this not having the Bunch-Davis vacuum means that I'm going to have a difference from the standard inflation prediction. Where will the difference arise? This is the interesting thing. The difference will arise in the modes which are the longest wavelength, whose wavelength is longer than the curvature radius at the onset of at the bounce up here. Well, if you translate to the CMB, these are the modes which are the longest wavelength. Roughly speaking, L equal to 30. So the longest wavelength modes, they are the ones which are excited. And because they are the ones which are excited, what happens is that you can have do the detailed calculations. I don't have time. You do the detailed calculations, and what you find is that in fact we can start with some initial states for which there is actually power suppression at the longest wavelengths. But for the shorter wavelengths, or larger k's, or larger l's, in fact, there is complete agreement both with observations and with the Bunch-Davis vacuum, the standard inflationary scenario. Or here, there is better agreement with observations than there is. And then there are predictions for future observations as to what will happen, what one should see. One will, for example, see a power suppression also for the electric polarization correlation functions, which one doesn't normally see, relative to the power to what the Bunch-Davis vacuum predicts. So these are really potential signatures of quantum gravity effects that one will be able to see. So let me just say this epilogue and then finish. Okay, let me begin with classical relativity. I think there are two messages I would like to communicate my viewpoints. The era of mathematical general relativity, a la Penrose, Geroche, Hawking, etc., which was dominated more by geometry than analysis, is coming to an end. It is replaced by geometric analysis and numerical relativity. Now, we heard about this morning. And gravity, as a whole, has entered the mainstream of astrophysics and cosmology. And it is at least an equal partner and could be a dominating partner once the new window with gravitation waves opens up fully. For quantum gravity, there are several distinct approaches. I think this diversity is very healthy. What has been achieved is rather different things in each of these approaches. Therefore, one could learn from each other. Advances have extended the reach of gravitational methods to other areas of science through string theory. And although these are modest by practical science, I think Einstein would have been astonished that you can calculate the correlation functions that are needed at high, strong coupling in a certain idealized superconductivity model using Green's functions on a black hole background. Okay. In other words, the two problems have nothing to do with each other. I use gravitational methods to solve some problem in condensed matter physics, for example. That is what is happening. And also, as I just sketched very, very, very briefly, that the spectacular advances in cosmology have now enabled a dialogue between theory and observations that are just coming. However, whereas in other areas of gravity, the communities have come together. We heard about this from Cliff, right? I mean, all the astrophysics people, the numerical people, the post-Newtonian people, they're talking to each other, all the time. In quantum gravity, they actually have steadily moved away. This really has happened since the mid-80s. I've seen it explicitly before people, maybe late 80s or early 90s. The main culprit, I think, is that there have been these bouts of irrational exuberance. And this is a quote from a biologist that made practitioners mix what they know and what they believe, thereby creating a misplaced sense of certitude. For sustained progress, it is important that the practitioners be aware of the limits of their science and thus their knowledge. And I think this comes from dialogue between the communities rather than isolation. So I think much more progress would occur if only there was more dialogue. Thank you.
Thank you. so now it's Steve.
That's good.